Welcome to this edition of In Tune with Opera Philadelphia. My name is Mike Bolton. I'm your host for this episode. We are thrilled to be joined by two of the stars of our new production, our new Laurent Pelly production of Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor, and our wonderful maestro, Corrado Avaris. Our stars, I guess I should mention, are Brenda Ray, who's singing Mad Lucy, and Michael Spires, who is not so mad, Edgardo. Hi, guys.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hello.
That comes with a caveat. Isn't
already,
he a little mad?
Yeah, I'm a little mad.
Corrado's all doing sort of a Mezzo-Metz hand motion. What is that about?
No, because I think that in this opera, almost everyone is a little mad. And from the top, you understand from the...
Who's the least mad character in this opera?
Oh. Yeah, maybe Raimondo, but still, you know, mm-hmm. Yes.
Or Aliza, let's not right. forget
yes,
about
yes,
her.
Yes, 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 you're right.
Corrado, we have to kind of talk about, not necessarily the elephant in the room, but we haven't done this opera since 1996.
Yeah.
What, maybe not necessarily why haven't we done it, but what has been the special occasion in bringing this opera back?
Everything happened because in 2014, we were doing Don Pasquale in Santa Fe with Laurent Pelly. And Laurent told me, I adore Donizetti, but I always did the comedies. And I would like to cross that line and to go to the Donizetti Serio. But I don't know, and I said, why we don't try in Philadelphia? And we do Lucia. And we were working with Brenda, so it was very natural to go. And so we had already three people together wanted to do Lucia. And of course, but here we are always think, no, and you know that, if we do a standard repertoire piece, we need something really special about that. Otherwise, we don't, you know, above all in a festival like this, but you want to say what is opera now mm-hmm. and what is opera in the future. So it was very important to find all the people in the cast in the same direction. So we always try to have Michael here, and finally we got him here for this project.
Welcome to Philadelphia.
Thank you, sir.
Yes. We have Troy that had really a long history with us. I think yesterday we were talking, I think we did six or seven titles together.
Yeah.
And so it's someone that belonged to our family, and we saw him growing and to go in this direction. And so I thought it was really the natural choice for that role. And with Christian Van Horn, we tried so many times to get him here. And I think that having a Raimondo like Christian brings everything to another level.
Mm.
You know, many times when I see this kind of operas, I feel that sometimes we pick one, two singers, then we think, oh, I think all the ingredients, they have to be at the top in order to have a wonderful experience in the theater. And also for us during the rehearsal process, I think that's really, to create the chemistry we're trying to create in these days, it's really the secret to have a wonderful result at the end.
And to think when he first came to Philadelphia, he didn't like to speak in public because he was concerned about his English.
Oh, it's beautiful.
So you have this amazing team together. You're putting your, what, day, what, you've been in rehearsal a week, more or less?
Michael and I came a bit late to the process, but yes, it's been a week today,
I
think.
Right. Maybe. How's it going? What's exciting about this for you guys as singers and musicians and everything else?
Well, for me, it's really a treat to sing in the United States because most of my career is based in Europe. And it's a very different system and different way of working here in the United States, and it's very refreshing how efficient and how wonderful the colleagues are really, really professional. I'm not saying that they aren't in Europe, but it's a completely different system, and many, many people in Europe are used to doing much more productions and many more presentations throughout the year, and so most people just don't have the possibility to be this prepared for an opera, to be totally honest. And this is incredible because we can actually get to the heart of the matter right from the beginning. You don't have other people that are standing around learning their music from scores. Mm-hmm. And we can really get to the true core of the meaning and create something truly artistic here. And it's a testament to Philadelphia to bring the right people for the right production is absolutely fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm very excited because this is, I think, the fourth production of Lucia that I've done, but it's already proving to be a very different look into the character of Lucia. Something I love about Laurent, the way he directs, he doesn't ever present a concept that's completely crazy or outside the box or that people wouldn't understand, but it's always very unique. He has a way of directing singers to make them find different aspects of the character, but it makes complete sense to the music and to the text. So I'm getting to explore parts of Lucia that I haven't explored before.
And can you give us an example?
Sure. I mean, when he and I talked this summer, because we just did another production of, we did Candide together, very different from Lucia, but he was already talking to me about how he wanted this Lucia to be very different, very special. And he thinks that Lucia is kind of almost like the family secret, that she's been, there's something already off about Lucia in the beginning of the opera, which makes complete sense because she does go mad in the end. And it's not like she was a normal person and then snapped. It's like there were already the tinges of madness in her. So we're trying to show the audience that a little bit, which is a challenge for me, but a wonderful challenge because it is there. It is there. It's very possible. And it's a very different relationship between Lucia and Edgardo. And I think it makes it a little more heartbreaking if Lucia is this isolated character. I mean, she's even isolated from the man who she thinks is her lover, but he's also in this relationship for reasons perhaps not just out of love. It's more political, and I really feel like Lucia becomes even more of a victim, and it's at the end, it's even more heartbreaking to see her fall so far.
It's a hard opera to do because there is this specter of singers of the past, conductors of the past, legendary Callas, von Karajan, Bonning and Sutherland, Pavarotti. What do you do with that as performers? What do you do with that?
I don't really worry about it, quite honestly. People, of course, are going to have their favorite Lucias, but I've listened to so many Lucias and love them all for their differences. And I've taken perhaps some ideas, but also have my own. And if the audience is waiting to hear Sutherland or Callas, well, that's maybe it's too bad for them because they are gone. Mm-hmm. And opera is a living art. So I can't worry about the fact that people might have their favorites. I have to show them a new favorite, there's always something new to show in a role.
Right.
So people should just come with open ears and open minds.
For me, in this part, it's a very interesting thing because Donizetti was one of the first people, other than I would say he might have been the first person who truly wanted to create an absolute drama throughout with every single character. Because every time that you get to a Donizetti opera, it's to the extremes of the story. You cannot get further in life or in the vocality of it. And believe me, I've done the most extreme operas, more so than any person alive. And Donizetti is the most difficult, maybe next to, and Berlioz would probably come in a second. And it's because they wanted to create such drama and such a new type of opera. And Donizetti knew the voice as well as any composer ever, and he knew exactly what to do and how to make them reach the pinnacle of their vocal abilities. And it's absolutely apparent in every single one of the characters, because it pushes everybody to the limits. Mm. And the interesting thing is that what I can bring to the character is the historical knowledge of how tenors used to sing this, and actually do what is written, because most people don't actually sing what Donizetti wrote and don't realize that Dupré was a special case throughout vocal history. And he wrote high E flats above high C and E naturals and Fs for these types of tenors, but most people don't do it now because the schooling now teaches you have to go one way or the other, and you're either a large dramatic voice or you're a light voice. But the problem is there was a huge time in history where that wasn't the case, and if you have a very light voice, you just can't cut through the orchestra, and if you have a really big voice, you just can't sing the score. And I approached it in a very different way, because I learned by doing. Basically, I sung the highest and the lowest roles possible, and then all of this started to happen where I could realize, oh, I can actually bring this different technique that I've learned. And I realized, oh yeah, just like everything, you're not new. There were 10 tenors before you that did this. And that's what I think, and hope that people will hear. It's something very different than any other Lucia that they've heard.
So how does Donizetti use the voice to help create drama, specifically in a maybe different way than Rossini or another character? Whereas you mentioned how he's really pushing the limits of vocality. How does he support the singer and how he's writing the role so that it's not a terror every night that you go on stage, unless it is a terror every night you go on stage.
See, it depends on your abilities and how much you've actually practiced the role and understood the role, because it literally is it is terrifying. Even if you're very secure in your technique, you go on, you go, hope this works. I think this is going to be good. And if you really care about the character, you will be slightly, you'll have that twinge of, I hope this goes. But the big thing that Donizetti did was when you had an outrageous moment where fits of rage and madness, he would write that into the score and the vocal line to be right around the breaking point of the voice to where the passaggio mm-hmm. is. And most of his tenor roles specifically, they're just written right in that very difficult part that took me about 8 years to be able to figure out, because I trained as a baritone starting out, and my teachers didn't know what to do with me, because they're like, well, you kind of could be a tenor, but you're probably a baritone. But Donizetti knew this, and he was at this kind of bow tie of the vocal arts, and he would push it just to the very max. So when you go to the, it doesn't matter which opera you're talking about, Rosamunde d'Inghilterra, or especially Les Martyrs, or this one in particular, it's written so that each of them, you have moments of being able to breathe. And he was very smart, because you can actually break it down very scientifically, because after about 4.5 minutes, he realizes that's a little bit too much. Let's bring it down here and repeat a different phrase that's a little calmer, you know. And just like Rossini, he studied the human condition and knew, okay, I don't think we should do a 7-minute, balls out, yelling moment. And because there's all of these parts written in for the voice to be able to calm down. But there are these huge, like her mad scene, that Lucia's mad scene is one of the most masterful pieces written for any vocalist whatsoever. Because everyone thinks, oh, it's high all the time. Like, no, actually, you have to have everything. And he knew exactly what the voice could do. And he, like Rossini was still at that transition, and Donizetti was in a different position as a person and a composer. Mm-hmm. And he wrote 72 operas, so he was so prolific and was able to experiment all the time. Rossini, he was taking the old school way and just keeping it like this, but then he was so smart that he would go, I'll test it out here, I'll test it out here. And his last opera, that's kind of when he just said, you know, and William Tell just said, mm-hmm. okay, I think this is what I can do for the arts. And he walked away. But Donizetti just kept going and actually became mad himself. And that's why it's so interesting how he understood the condition of madness.
So, Corrado, how do you support, you know, you think of Rubato and you think of all of these ways that the conductor has to support the architecture of the drama through this music. How are you supporting the singers? How are you encouraging the drama? What are the things about Donizetti that you like to bring out that helps that?
I think that the principal concept about Donizetti is really, I was telling Michael yesterday this story, when I was a course master alla Scala, there was the Donizetti expert conducting it, was Gian Andrea Gavazzini, from Bergamo as well. And so I had to conduct my first opera, and he was conducting Stifelli alla Scala, I remember. And I went in his dressing room with my score. I said, somebody said, now tell me what I have to do. And he told me, so the first thing you have to do is to forget what we did, my generation did. Because he said, we approach Donizetti going back from our time. So if you go back like that, you don't find really something what is more than about Donizetti. But if you don't know the future, you think to be in that moment of the history and you are coming from before, you will find really the most modern composer. And I tried always to keep that in mind. Mm-hmm. So you find details in the score that you can take for granted, but no, they are very modern in that moment. Maybe very hidden lines in the violas or in the celli. So my job is to bring out that, because not because it's written, but because it helps a lot to understand really what it was in that moment, the most important thing, in my opinion.
So, looking at the sextet, off the top of my head, I don't know if there's anything quite like it that comes before, not knowing every single opera, of course, but if you look at it as a musical dramatic moment, the way he... As much as we think of it as almost like a concert piece, that let's schedule the sextet because it's nice, but musically and dramatically, it is the pivotal moment in the drama, and Donizetti is such a master at bringing in the conflicting emotions of each character, setting the text in a brilliant way, but also wrapping up the audience in this drama as well. So we really feel for each of these characters, because it's so, everyone's moment in that scene is just so different. How do you work with that as a conductor, but also as performers, to bring that magic all together?
Yes, but I think that's the secret of why Lucia was always in the repertoire. You know Donizetti because of Elixir, Pasquale, and Lucia, but really the one was always there from the first day. Mm-hmm. It's Lucia. Oh. Because of what you were saying about the audience, what is the success? Above all, in that moment, it's not that you have internet, TV, you don't have anything like that. But when you leave the house after the performance, you remember some very specific moments in the mm-hmm. opera. That's the difference about having a continuous success in the 19th century. So you go to see Lucia, thinking that moment, you remember the sextet, because it's so powerful. You remember the medicine. It's divided in a way, but it's very, for the audience, you understand from the prelude, because it's not an overture, but it's like Rigoletto, you understand immediately that there is something wrong here. And so there is an R, and at the end, it makes complete sense that the two of them are going to die. It's really very good about that, and that's the secret. If you think in that moment of, because about stopping the action before the concertato finale, Rossini does very, very often that, mm-hmm. in a different way. But the concept about the path, the dramaturgia of the opera, it was very common, you know. Barbiere, fermo ed immobile, mm-hmm. come una statua.
mm-hmm. Esatto.
Yeah, it's that. So it was really atypical. But Donizetti is able, in this extent, what you were saying, to create different tensions inside. But it's really about the arc and the construction belongs to that, but mm-hmm. with a different, with the added value to the idea.
Yeah. Great. Brenda, this is your second time with us here in Philadelphia. Hopefully it won't be the last time. The Academy of Music is a unique house in the States, at least. It's not thousands and thousands and thousands of seats. It's just thousands of seats. But it's a much more intimate space. What was your experience like as a singer in Tancredi, which was, what, a year and a half ago?
Yeah.
And then coming back for it again.
Well, I love singing here. I'm also a performer who's done most of her work in Europe, mm-hmm. so I'm used to a smaller mm-hmm. house, and I really like that. I think you can do more mm-hmm. as an actress. You don't have to play these huge gestures. It can be more, not film, but I think you need to find that balance of making a gesture big enough, making an expression big enough so the audience sees, but when it's a smaller theater, you can do less and it makes it more realistic, mm-hmm. and I think it gets you touch people yeah. easier. So my job was easier here, it was great. And also the theater's so beautiful yeah. and it's so historic.
Yeah. pardon me for interrupting, but I popped in yesterday and you and Troy were working on the duet, and I love being in the rehearsal hall just because of the intimacy of it. And no one is worrying about filling 2,500 seats. But it's that immediacy of expression.
Mm-hmm.
And you were right by the door. I don't even know the line. Soffriva il pianto.
Soffriva nel pianto.
Yeah, and it was, I was drawn into the drama, even in a rehearsal space, mm-hmm. and just the musicality and the expressiveness, but the intimacy of it as well. Yes, we are in a smaller space, but I don't like bel canto. So I know. And I have to tell you, Tancredi, it was the Wednesday performance of Tancredi. I think, anyway, one of the performances of Tancredi. And suddenly I got it. And I was like, oh my gosh, I might like Norma now. That was not the case, but anyway. but it was what you brought to the music, which changed my perception of bel canto.
Well, thanks. Oh. And makes me very happy.
And I don't have your album yet, but it's on my things, my wish list.
That's quite all right. A lot of people don't.
But it was that same intimacy that you showed here, and the same concentration and the same dedication. What's happening in that scene?
Well, I think if you fully invest yourself in any scene, you'll reach the audience. I believe in this music so much. I love it so much. And I people who don't like bel canto usually say, well, the stories are silly. And
mm-hmm.
I think if you go into a piece thinking it's silly, then of course the audience is going to think it's silly. So it's my job to find a character, believe in the character's struggle. And that way I have a much greater chance of reaching the audience. Specifically in that scene that you came mm-hmm. in the rehearsal, Lucia has just found out that her lover, Enrico's tricking her into thinking that her lover Edgardo has betrayed her. And so that was the one piece of hope that she was holding on to. And now even that has been taken away from her. So mm-hmm. it's the most heartbreaking moment. It is what mm-hmm. starts the descent into madness,
mm-hmm.
into full madness.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to say, no, I mean,
sure.
you recorded it or not, but it was just about the bel canto thing. And one of the only things that listeners and you and everybody needs to keep in mind, that bel canto can only be viewed, you can view it however you want, but the only way that really makes sense in the modern times is to understand archetypes.
Mm.
Because every single character within bel canto repertoire is an archetype. It's the furthest you can go in the human form to becoming a god or a demon. And most people don't realize that that's we live through story. And bel canto was the height of getting to the absolute edge of what we could do as humans before we'd become gods. And if you really think of every single one of these characters, it's like, well, they don't make sense. But yes, it does. If you've ever met like the most intense person ever, that's who Edgardo is. If you've met someone who's been put in a terrible situation like Lucia, and born into a family where she has no choice whatsoever. And from the other thing you have to keep in mind with this opera too, this was set in old Scotland, and it's no coincidence that this story took place and how it was based on. It took place in there. You have to realize that windows are a modern thing, mm-hmm. and Scotland and a lot of things are very cold. And when you have windy, cold going through your entire life the entire time, I mean, there was no such thing as windows. They had certain covers, but mm-hmm. for the most part, places were cold all the time, and you had to live with being cold, and some people couldn't deal with that. And
cold,
I mean,
and
just
dark.
Exactly. And think about how much that messes with your psyche. Mm-hmm. And people don't realize that until you go up north for a winter. Really go up north and see how you feel after a week of darkness and cold. And this kind of madness was, I wouldn't say much more common, but it was more common. It was more common, and it really is nowadays. You can still see in the statistics of the northern countries, people have very hard lives. They're much more drawn to alcoholism or tribalism or suicide. Mm-hmm. That is a factor in this, and people don't really think of that because we live in our wonderful worlds where everything's air conditioned, and then it's too cold, let's turn it down. But they were living against the elements, and that's what bel canto truly was too. You were living against the raw power of nature and the world, and most of us forget that nowadays because everything is just to our liking. Mm-hmm. And bel canto was the attempt to show the human condition and how we can be something great. Even if it's and you have to look at it as, all of them as archetypes of players within a story, and not just one person. Well, that person's a jerk. Like, yeah, that person needs to be a jerk in order to make this character work. And that's the weird thing. You really have to break it down psychologically, because during that period of bel canto, everyone was coming together to try to create the greatest piece of art and do something new. But the only way they could do that was to break it down to the archetypes of the characters. And once you start looking at it through that lens, you start to realize, wow, bel canto is absolutely genius. It's like Mozart and Rossini. When you break it down to that, you're like, many people think, oh, Rossini's just Rossini. He's like, try conducting it. You know, every conductor that I've asked, who's the hardest conductor person to conduct Rossini? I'm like, really? Come on. Everyone says it's easy. I'm like, they're not very smart then. Because it's bare bones of everything, and people, you have to break it down to a more psychological level, and I think audiences now are craving that, because we're all listening to podcasts, we're listening to these long form discussions, and we need to dig a little bit deeper as audience members and as singers to understand specifically this moment, because everything is there. All of these people were influenced by the Enlightenment, and specifically the great thinkers, Goethe, and all of these wonderful plays. This is what this is about, and that's why bel canto is so strong, and why it's never going to go away. And people are like, oh, it's just fireworks for the boys. No, it's not. Yeah. No, it's not.
I'm really excited about this. One, because we haven't done it in so long. One, mm-hmm. second, because it's an extraordinary cast. I've never heard you live, Michael, so okay. I'm super, super, super excited to hear you.
Well, I'll hope to live up to your expectations.
But because you guys are new, Just tell us about yourselves. And for Corrado, so we haven't really had the chance in any of these to really talk to you about your background and what your hobbies are. And
let's start with our guest.
Okay. Let's start with life. The prima donna.
The prima donna, the life of a prima donna. I go home to my two-year-old and change diapers still. It's very glamorous. But yeah, my life as an opera singer started a little, not late, I always knew I loved to sing, but I wasn't convinced that I wanted to sing opera until I was about 20. I was in music school, but my teachers knew that I was more interested in jazz and even singer-songwriting, kind of. I wanted to be like a Tori Amos / Trent Reznor Nine Inch Nails. I was, you know, a little hardcore. But I was introduced to La Sonnambula, another bel canto piece, and my teachers had me do a scene, the final sleepwalking scene, and I just fell absolutely in love with it. And then I remember getting this CD where that scene was on. It was one of Anna Mofo's CDs called La Bellissima. It was recordings when she was very young. Mm-hmm. She was about 24 to 26, I think, and I was just blown away. And the mad scene was on that as well. And so I thought, okay, if I can do bel canto, I'm going to go for this opera career. And I haven't looked back since. Yeah.
That's cool. How about you, Michael?
I come from a family of all musicians. We actually call ourselves the Hillbilly Von Trapps. My sister's a Broadway singer, currently singing in Carousel.
Oh, nice.
My brother and I run an opera company together called the Springfield Regional Opera in Missouri. I'm from a very small town, about 1,400 people, but I'm very prideful of my town and area because it's the home of Laura Ingalls Wilder, who is a Little House on the Prairie, and I grew up the most Americana that you can possibly imagine. Mm-hmm. My mother would write plays that we would perform and annoy neighbors and things with, because as I grew up, my father was my band and choir director, and then later my mom was my choir and drama teacher. So we're all musicians, and that's what we've all done. But I grew up doing every kind of thing that you can think of, and opera was a very small part of my life. It was mainly folk and bluegrass and, you know, torch tunes and things like that. And the funny thing is that what really made me turn into an opera singer, other than the backstory, whom I was named after is my late uncle, his dream in life was to be an opera singer. I mean, I only met him because he died when I was 1 year old, so I met him very briefly. But I was his namesake, and it was his dream to be an opera singer. And he was a bit mad, to be honest. The only possessions that he really had in his life was his opera collection. He had about 20 records, and he spent all of his money. He was a singing waiter in Vegas and in L.A., and the only possessions that he had literally was 20 different records. And the only people that he loved was Caruso and Mario Lanza. And the only people that my mom grew up and knew anything about the opera world was that. And I inherited those. And as I was growing up, you know, I listened to those kind of records. My parents would always put it on weekends. And they're like, maybe someday you'll be an opera singer like your uncle, you know. And it wasn't any kind of a pushing thing, but it was interesting, always having them in the back of my head. But then when I was 18 on a senior trip, my first CD that I actually bought when CDs were like really the thing was Mario Lanza's Greatest Hits. And I just, it was funny because I was a high school kid, and I was listening to this music for the millionth time, but it really hit me. And I was sitting in my room with my father. We were on a senior trip, and everybody else went out to explore the city of Chicago, and I sat there for 3 hours listening to Mario Lanza, because it hit me so deeply. And I realized, maybe this is something that I can do. And then I went to college on a musical theater scholarship and acting and things like that. But then I realized, wait a minute, I think I could be an opera singer now that I kind of understand what this is. And the opera company that I'm now the artistic director of, that's who gave me my start. Mm-hmm. It's amazing story. And then, I went to school for 2 years, and then I came here. And the funny thing, the last time I was in Philadelphia was actually for the Mario Lanza competition about 19 years ago. And, you know, I just quit school in Missouri because I thought, I'm going to make this my own. And I quit school and lived with my parents and became a construction worker. And I kind of lived vicariously through the idea of Mario Lanza because I don't know. I was a little mad and thought that maybe I'm the reincarnation of Lanza. I don't know, maybe. So I saved up all my money to come here to do the competition. I was like, hey, I'm going to make it. Yeah, and now I got nowhere. And I went back home and I thought, maybe I'm not going to be an opera singer. So then I just kept working construction and then learning how to be a singer on my own. And then after about 3 years, I'd saved up enough money from being in choirs and things that I bought a one-way ticket to Europe and cornered myself and said, better make it, because I know I can't. I'm a small-town person, but now my life revolves around big cities and big operas. But it's so funny because I knew that I couldn't make it in the States doing what I wanted to. I wanted to do the most obscure and crazy, bizarre operas like Lucia and all of these really bizarre things that really excite my interest. And it's nearly impossible just the way that the U.S. is set up to do that, although it's now changing. But 20 years ago when I got into the scene, you know, it's like, okay, if you want that kind of career, you have to move to Europe. So that was the dream, and that's how I really got into it. And it was a long struggle, but about 8 years of trying to turn into a tenor, and finally it clicked and went, oh, that's how they do it. It's all fake. So then I just, the career just really started and took off in about 10 years ago. That's when it really started.
Awesome. What about you, Corrado?
I was born in Bergamo. And my father is a musician. And so when I was 14, I moved to Milan to study music. And I started more with Baroque music because I was playing harpsichord, organ, piano. But then being in Milan, I was lucky enough to be involved with La Scala, and I loved from the first moment opera when I started working there. And after working 5 years at La Scala, I started conducting, but mostly from the harpsichord, Baroque music. And then step by step, I tried to build my repertoire chronologically, and now I moved to the United States 14 years ago.
What was the first opera you conducted?
The first opera I conducted from the harpsichord was Il Filosofo di Campagna di Baldassarre Galuppi.
Wow. Scure.
Yeah. And the second, La Diavolessa by Baldassarre Galuppi. Huh.
And what was the first recognizable repertoire that you conducted?
Elixir d'Amore.
And where was that?
Was in Milan. There is a young artist program called Aslico. And I was preparing the singers with Leila Genscher. We were touring in the north of Italy.
That production, that specific production, because that's where Jessica started, Aslico. I was getting ready to audition for it, for that was right when I moved to Europe, and I almost audition for that.
Yes, it's an important way to be exposed
for that one.
So let me ask you all a question. You're a kid. When you were a kid and you have those private moments when you're alone in your bedroom or in the bathroom, wherever, and you're singing your heart out to whatever song it was on the radio or whatever, what were you singing?
I was doing a lot of Tori Amos.
When I was a kid, it depends. I'm very schizophrenic in my nature. So it was either something from Roger Miller, the old-timey country artist, probably Dang Me, or Be My Love from Mario Lanza. Very different, but that's me.
For me, I was not singing, but I was playing a lot from the real book, you know, the standard jazz. Yes. Because during the summer when I was a teenager, I was playing piano bar in Sardinia.
Really?
Yes.
That's cool. All right, so if you don't have your tickets to see this great, great cast and this wonderful production of Lucia de Lammermoor, they are available online at operafila.org, and they are part of our wonderful 018 festival, which includes Lucia de Lammermoor, Sky on Swings, which is a new opera by Lembit Beecher and Hannah Moskowitz. And we also have Nikita Pa, which is a reworking of Poulenc's wonderful La Voix Humaine. And then Queens of the Night, which is our cabaret extravaganza featuring Stephanie Blythe and Martha Graham Cracker. and Glass Handle, which is Anthony Roth Costanzo's exploration of not a glass handle, but Philip Glass and George Friedrich Handel. Someone just asked me, it's about a glass handle. Like, no, it's not about a glass handle. But thank you guys for taking time out during your lunch break
in Lucia Riverfield. This is great.